I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection. Our guest this hour, Muhammad Yunus, says that if he were looking for one single thing to help the poor overcome poverty, it would be credit in lots and lots of small doses. He's come to this conclusion after 25 years of making small loans to people with no credit at all. Muhammad Yunus is founder of the Grameen Bank, which is Bangladesh's largest rural credit institution. His banking philosophy is in part a war on poverty, in part a human rights campaign, and in part just good business. Give the poorest of the poor small chunks of capital from $25 to $500, and they can open a grocery, or buy a cow and sell its milk, or buy a cell phone and start a phone service, or finance a rice husking business. Hundreds and hundreds of microlenders based in the United States, Latin America, Africa, and Europe have taken pages out of the Grameen Book of Banking. The poor, it turns out, are a very good risk. The rate of return on loans, I should say, the safety, the security of these loans is better than 97%. We're talking about micro-lending this hour. Connection listeners, does it sound to you like banking or social welfare, capitalism or charity? Could credit really put an end to poverty? Our guest, Muhammad Yunus, speaks of eliminating poverty in the world in the next 30 or 40 years with small bits of credit. 1-800-423-8255 makes the micro-lending connection, or 1-800-423-TALK. Welcome, Muhammad Yunus.
Thank you.
This is an important idea. Tell us how it works at the village level, at small levels in Bangladesh today. Who applies? Who screens them? What connections do they have to have? What commitment? And then what happens?
It's very simple. The idea is very simple. People need money. The poorer you are, the more need you have for the money. But they are the one who never get money because the financial institution will never reach out to you. They're busy with people who already have a lot of money. So we thought maybe we can try this way, lending money to the extremely poor people. And we began in one village back in 1976, giving 42 people a total of $27. That was our starting point. And it worked. People paid back, although bankers were telling us that poor people will never pay back. Actually, I found out they did. They did. Not a single penny was missed. So we did it again and continued to do it. And every time we found out that money is coming back.
42 loans averaging $27 for what?
Not averaging. Total amount for 42 people.
Oh,
less
good.
Than a dollar apiece.
65 cents apiece or something.
Absolutely, yes, indeed. That's how we started. And amazing how people's needs are so small, but nobody pays any attention to kind of money.
I fish $27 out of my pocket and say, let's put this money to work. What happens?
And people take that money, use it to invest in whatever their work they're doing, raw materials.
But we'd expect people to go and buy their lunch for those, you know, that less than a dollar. How does it get invested in?
We go through that kind of preparation. We discuss this problem of finishing it up by eating your lunch, or you invest and wait for the lunch to generate from the investment. We said you can eat up the tree, and that way tree is gone. But if you wait for the fruit, every season you'll get the fruit. The tree remains, and this is the best bet of your investment.
What was the business plan of the people who... the 42 people who got this $27 bounty?
A business plan is something they will sit down together, who needs what, for how much money, what they will be doing. Screening is done by the people themselves. The system that we evolved over years is each case is a five-member group. If a poor person wants to borrow money, she will be asked to find four other friends to form a group of five. And that group of five becomes sort of a loan committee. And they will screen each other's loan and recommend to the bank. And bank will go through the procedure of seeing that what they said is right and then give the money. And the money is paid back in weekly installment. And friends will see over that everything is okay. Because if anyone is creating trouble, the others get into problem of not getting loans from the bank. So there's a kind of common interest to keep the group moving. And we give two loans to begin with to two persons out of the five and wait for a couple of weeks or 4 weeks, 5 weeks, 6 weeks to see everything is okay. Everything in Grameen Bank is done in weekly installments. You pay tiny little installment over your loan so that in within a year you pay back the entire loan. So in the, along the way you can find out whether things are working out right or some glitch is coming into it. So if everything goes well, then we give loans to the next two persons, which again approved by the group, recommended by the group, and we give it to them. And we wait again to see if everything is okay so far. If everything goes right, then the final person gets the loan. So there's an interest to keep it alive, keep it moving, and so on.
And what kind of a business have we started here in the meantime?
In the meantime, people initially, if the first-time borrower would be investing it in husking rice, buying paddy from the market and husk it at home and sell the clean rice, immediately it produces income for them. Or another simple thing is raising chicken, poultry, sell eggs from the chicken, or buy yourself a cow and sell the milk, pay back the bank, and you become the owner of the cow and the calf. Or weave baskets, weave all kinds of products, cane products, or weave textile products, handloom products, and so on. The things that they are familiar with, and there's a market available right next door. It's a local market. People can sell the stuff. And as you earn, you pay back the loan and continue to earn more. And after you pay back the first loan, you are ready for the next loan. Usually you expand your business and move on from there. So this is basically what happens. And the basic principle of Grameen Bank is people should not come to the bank. Banks should go to the people. Today, after now some 23 years, we work in 40,000 villages of Bangladesh, out of 68,000 total in Bangladesh. So in every second village all over Bangladesh, Grameen presence is there. And we lend to 2.4 million borrowers right now, to 2.4 million families, actually. And 95% of our borrowers are women. Today, there's all the very different varieties of activities in which they invest the money, and the loan size has grown over time because they are no more confident in paying back the loan and
why women?
When we began, my criticism against the conventional bank was that not only they deny loans to the poor people, they also deny loan to the women. And I told them, look, if you look at all the women, all the borrowers in all the banks in Bangladesh, if you look at the gender composition, not even 1% of the borrowers will be women. There's something wrong with your system. So when I began, I wanted to make sure half the borrowers in my work are women. But the women themselves didn't want to do that. They were actually running away from me when I wanted to get them into the system. They said, look, don't give me the money because I don't know what to do with the money. Because I never touched money. I never used money in my life. You give it to my husband. He's the one who understands money. I said, no. This money is for you. If you want, if you need, if you can use, think about it, come back to me and I'll give you the loan. Gradually, some people dared to get in, some women dared to get in, and others felt encouraged over the years. It took us 6 years to come to the level of 50-50 composition of men and women. Then we saw money that went to the family through women brought so much more benefit to the family. They took good care of the children. Children became the beneficiary of mother earning income. And women had longer vision in their life. They wanted to build up to something, unlike men who wanted to enjoy right away rather than wait for tomorrow or next day. So we saw so much more benefits in entering the family through women, giving the credit to the women. We switched our policies. We started giving priority to women. Today, 95% of the borrowers are women. And many of the good things you will hear about Grameen, I think is because women are in charge of that money and in charge of this activity.
This is fascinating. What is the emphasis? What does it mean that the emphasis is on very small individual loans as opposed to, say, big community projects, publicly financed?
If you're looking at the publicly financed, usually it will go to the rich people. Because poor are never get into the any picture of any bigger community projects. If it's a road building, if it's a, some electricity project or whatever community type of projects, the poor will come as a kind of day laborer. It's a take your wage, go home. If you have some opportunity to get involved, that's only involvement. They're not in the decision making. They're not in the participating in the, in designing anything. So here, you give the money, they translate their ability into exactly the way they are capable of in earning money. And so their creativity comes out. All people have their own creativity. And I have been arguing that creativity-wise, there is no difference between richest man in the world and the poorest person in the world. So only difference is the other guy got the opportunity to bring it out, and the person at the bottom never got the opportunity to bring it out. That's the difference. So this money becomes the key to open himself or herself up, explore the possibilities and creativities that are buried into the person. So each stage is an exploration process. So unlike a job work where you do the work and go home, you never know what you are because you never got a chance to explore yourself. So this gives the opportunity. And gradually they find out that they know more things, they have more abilities than anybody ever told them. And that leads to the next step to explore further. And gradually, every person gets to the next level and the next level. So the Grameen is not only about lending money. It's not about money. It's about people. It's exploring the self-worth of a person and establishing the dignity of the person. That's what it's all about.
When does this sort of awakening of sort of ownership and the spirit behind it, when does it begin to affect the fate of a whole nation like Bangladesh? And when you talk about eliminating poverty through small credit over the next 30, 40 years, how do we get there in terms of not only distribution of the sense of entitlement and of investment, but in terms of production?
Yeah. It's a slow process, obviously, because what happened in centuries, you're trying to change it completely. So it takes years and decades. The signs that you see today, everybody tells, all the researchers telling that people who joined Grameen Bank are coming out of poverty. At least one-third of them are over the poverty right now. This is one good sign. Nutrition level-wise, it's much better in the Grameen families and non-Grameen families. Literacy among the children of Grameen families way higher than the literacy in non-Grameen families. Housing condition in Grameen families is much better than in non-Grameen families. Mm-hmm. So you have a whole list of all those items. Adoption of family planning practices is twice as high in Grameen families than in non-Grameen families. Child mortality has reduced by 37% in Grameen families than in non-Grameen families. So you have a whole list of them.
It's a whole social, political, emotional program.
And then in the elections, in the political process. In 1996, Bangladesh had the general election of electing a new parliament. And that election, 73% of the voters voted in that election. It's way higher than our normal record in the past. And particularly, that's what is very impressive, more women voted in that election than men, which never have happened in Bangladesh's history. This is because now women who are taking credit and becoming conscious about their political rights, they came in numbers and voted and outnumbered the male voters in the whole country. As a result, the fundamentalist party in the parliament was completely wiped out because women never liked the fundamentalist party because whatever they say is very threatening to the women in Bangladesh. So this is another result. The next year in 97, there were local level elections. In the local level elections, not only Grameen borrowers voted in that election like they did in the national election, they became candidates. More than 4,000 of Grameen members became elected in the local level bodies, and two of them became chiefs of the local bodies. So you see, these are the poor women, never spoke their mind, never opened their mouth. They're always stayed behind. Now coming and participating in the electoral process, influencing the national electoral composition and so on. So these are the signs that what happens when you empower people at the very bottom.
You've lived and studied in this country. You got your PhD in this country. I wonder what you think the application is to life in the States, where there are large parts of the population that are poor, that are excluded from credit, that also don't participate in elections, but in a lot of national life. What are the implications for a very rich country like ours?
Oh, well, it's obvious. I mean, what I'm saying about Bangladesh, it will happen in much more forcefully in a country like the United States, where communication is so easy, people understand it's very easy. But that financing is not available. You go to all the conventional banks, you'll see how many people they reject, because in their eligibility condition, a lot of people in this country will not qualify to enter into a bank to borrow money. So that's where the Grameen-type banking is absolutely necessary, so that you can address that and people can change their own life by their own efforts. While you do not have that, like many other countries or the whole world do not have that procedure. So if that kind of thing, financial system can be established so that everybody is entitled to borrow money, at least eligible to borrow money, then they can come and create their own life. And instead, what you have a huge big welfare system where you have to, you can receive government assistance or state assistance to maintain yourself while you are not earning money. I agree with the very spirit and the philosophy of having the welfare and the support for these people who do not have access to income. But I would always say that this should be a temporary residence of people who would be taking state support. There will be efforts to get them out so that they become income-earning person and self-respecting person. But today, the way the welfare laws exist in the country, they rather restrict them getting out of the welfare rather than encourage them. There are some efforts to encourage them, but there may be many more efforts to encourage them. If we have options like a credit option, whether you should take a loan or you should take a grant as a welfare benefit, I'm sure many people would go for loan options and change their life in that direction.
We're talking about micro-lending with the man who made it famous with the Grameen Bank in Bangladesh. The phone is 1-800-423-8255. Mohammed Yunus is our guest in the studio. Maria Otero joins us from Washington, D.C. by phone. She runs Axion, the largest micro-lender in the United States. Maria Otero, thank you for joining us. What is the relevance of this kind of very, very small credit to poor people? What is the relevance to Estados Unidos here?
Thank you for having me on the program, and hello, Eunice.
Hi, Maria.
Well, indeed, we are finding that the work that we did in Latin America, that Axion developed in Latin America, actually had something that it could bring to the United States, because the pockets of poverty in this country are quite large. And Axion, doing a study, learned that there are over 13 million people in this country who have a small business and who have no access to credit, either because they don't qualify for credit from a bank, or because they were unable to follow up on a loan that they may have had in the past. And so therefore, for them to be able to stay out of poverty and to be able to work their way out of welfare in some cases, they need to be able to access capital, as Axion does in Latin America.
Give an example. What do you mean by a small business that can't get credit? I mean, you're talking about a house cleaning service?
For example, if you take, say, a woman in New York who might have been dependent on welfare and might be able to develop, say, a daycare center out of her house, or somebody who might be doing a cleaning service, or a person who might be making food in their house as a kind of small caterer. These people, having no access to capital, cannot really run their business. And the Axion work is really to put very small loans in their hands, usually beginning with about loans of $500, averaging more than that, and enabling them with that capital to develop their very small business. What we have found in this country is that people really patch together their source of income when they are poor people, where there are people that are really living at the edge. And Axion has found that if you are able to put a small amount of capital into a household so that they can run a small business, they will be able to earn enough income so that they can, they don't just fall over the edge and remain dependent. And
so, very practically speaking, with people who are poor to begin with and credit starved for the business, how do you segregate the two? How do you say this is for the business? It's not for today, tonight, the next meal.
I think the best way that Axion has been able to do that, because economists use this word fungible. You know, money, right. Money goes in and then it can be used for anything. But you work very closely with people and also helping understand the plan that they have for their business. The loan officers that go out through the Axion organizations that we work with are also beginning seeing what kind of capital is needed. They make sure that the amount that's lent to people is not more than they can pay back. and you work with each of the clients in a way in which you are being supportive to their business activity. And people in the programs that Acción has been working with have a repayment rate of over 98% in Latin America and about 94% in this country. So you can see that that money that is going in is generating money, and then people can pay back their loans. You will see also that people desperately need their business in order to be able to survive, to make a living for their family. And so they will take this very small amount of money and use it in a way that allows them to grow this. And certainly Acción, in doing its work, unlike Grameen, lends to men and to women, both in this country and in Latin America. And we have noted that in both cases, people understand very clearly the importance of how their hard work combined with the capital that Acción makes available really changes their lives and enables them to move to a level of not just empowerment, but also capacity to make decisions for the future.
Could I just ask, what does it mean to you, Maria Otero, to speak of credit as a human right, as Mohamed Yunus does?
I would say that Acción and I myself, in the many years that I've worked in this, would see credit more as what we try to do is really create access by millions of poor people to capital. In Latin America, as it is in this country, these people have no access to this credit because they are considered not creditworthy by the banks. They are creditworthy to us, and they are people that are already involved in developing business activities. And from our perspective, creating that access is not what we would call a human right. We would call it more a capacity to have something that will allow you to bring yourself out of poverty. And that is made available to those that have an employment or that have a business and that can use this. Most of the people that Acción works with are people who already have an ongoing business, whether it's a woman in Guatemala that is selling oranges on the street or a woman in the streets of the Bronx that is making tamales and selling them. Most of the people that we are working with have already tried to find ways to survive by using their own tenacity, their own inventiveness, and their own rigor to be able to fend for their families. And so all we do is bring in small amounts of credit. In Latin America, we begin with loans that are under $100 and help these people bring themselves up so that when you have, for example, a woman that is making bread out of a mud oven with a little bit of capital, that woman will be able to produce a lot more, and then we'll be able to build a second mud oven and so on, arrive at a point where maybe she will be borrowing a loan of maybe $3,000, but at this point you will see that she's baking bread out of five mud ovens and she is producing a great deal more and even providing employment for people.
Maria Otero, stand by. We're talking about micro-lending in Bangladesh, in Latin America, in the United States. 1-800-423-8255 makes the micro-lending connection. Allison is on the line.
Hi.
Hello, Allison.
Okay, my question is a little bit, let me try to make it as clear as I can. Here's the thing. It seems to me that there's a couple different factors when you're sort of thinking about extending credit that could affect, you know, how effective the rate of return, essentially. And it seems like one could be a story that's basically about discrimination, that these people are just not receiving credit just because of some sort of discrimination, particularly in like Bangladesh, against women, sort of for cultural or social reasons. But it seems like there could also be two other factors. One would be this kind of story that it's sort of the mix of people that are seeking credit. You know, that the reason banks don't want to lend to them is because they perceive them as worse credit risks in some way by the very fact that they're seeking out credit in the first place. And then I guess the third factor would be,
if you need the loan really bad, you can't have it.
Right. Right, exactly. Mm-hmm. That the very people who are going to be seeking it out are the kind of people you wouldn't want to lend to. And then I guess the third possible kind of factor could be that once people already get the credit, if there's not strong enough consequences, you know, to sort of prevent them from default, then, you know, then they could they could essentially use it in a bad way. So,
Mohammed, give Mohammed Yunus a chance to respond.
Yeah, you can go on listing as many causes of conventional institutions not lending money. But what microcredit programs all over the world are showing, despite the presence of all those factors, people can take the money, pay back the money with interest and carry on and improve their life. So we can refine this, we can improve this and overcome all other problems. You said about the discrimination against women in Bangladesh. It's not discrimination against women in Bangladesh or anywhere. It's a discrimination against the poor people. It's not men and women both are rejected by the system. What we did, we deliberately went to women, which is a very difficult process in a Muslim country to reach out to women to get her to be participant in an income generating activity. So that is an additional mileage. But the real thing is there's a kind of apartheid existing in the conventional banking, a wall which doesn't they do not cross that wall to reach out to people who have been rejected by the system. So that's where the microcredit comes in.
I've seen you quoted saying that the question isn't, are people creditworthy? It should be, are banks peopleworthy? We're talking about microlending with the father of it in Bangladesh, Mohammed Yunus. Thank you, Maria Otero from Acción, for joining us. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston and PRI Public Radio International. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation, empowering people with innovative internet technology and offering dynamic career opportunities at Allaire.com. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection, the micro-lending connection with Mohammed Yunus, who founded the Grameen Bank in Bangladesh. They've made loans to almost 2.5 million people over the years, a lot of them extremely small, some of them less than a dollar, with important results. You're talking about a revolution in small capitalism. I wonder, how would you describe the politics of this thing? Is this right, left, center, or what?
Well, I would say we are basically disliked by right, left, center, all directions.
tell us about your enemies. Who's against this program?
Well, the extreme left thing, this is something from the capitalist world. We are trying to bring capitalism at the grassroots so that the social revolution never takes place in those countries, wherever it goes. And the right things, this is a revolutionary because you are organizing the poor people to take over the power and so on and so forth. And the religious people think we are destroying their religion, whatever religion they are in, by distorting their relationship with the family members. Like women staying home, now you are destroying their relationship with the home and the family by taking them out in the marketplace and earning money, controlling money, and then defying their husbands or whatever fear they may have. So we have all kinds of accusation, and I don't mind that. I don't mind that because, after all, it's a new thing. It never happened in history before. So everybody who has settled in their own equilibrium feel disturbed. So they try to attack that. But while that acquisition and while that opposition comes in, at the same time, tremendous amount of support is generated from all directions, irrespective of which quarter of politics you belong to.
And what do you how does it seem to yourself? What is your own intention? Who are your political heroes? Well, what's your goal?
My intention is to give more freedom to people. I'm saying that the people have enormous capacity, enormous potential to take care of their own life. But the system we have created in such a way, it distorts, it takes away that freedom from people. I wanted to restore that freedom and ensure that freedom. I'm saying that poverty is not created by the poor people. Poverty is created by the institutions we build, by the policies that we pursue. So we have to go back to those institutions at the drawing board. So design institutions who are poor friendly, who extend the same facilities they extend to some other people and the rich people. So financial institution was one example. Communication system is another example. The bigger you are, more tools you have to communicate with the rest of the world. Poor do not have. With the new kind of information technology which is generated, I think the poor has the best chance possible, unprecedented opportunity to have access to information. So information and microcredit can have very empowering situation for people.
Does the bank make money for itself? Does it make big money for you?
I'm just an employee of the bank. I don't own the bank. The bank is owned by the borrowers. So nobody outside the borrower community can have a share in the bank. So it's a complete circle. Borrowers owning the bank and taking money from the bank and paying back. Yes, it covers its cost. It doesn't make enormous money, but it covers its cost. That's a great thing about it, because people think that it cannot be done. Initially, we depended on assistance from outside, like we had soft loans from international organization, we had grants from international organization, but we have come to a level where now we can take care of ourselves. We don't have to take any external soft loans or grant money anymore. So this is the big message is, that poor can take things in their own way without anybody's mercy or anybody's handout, and they can make their own life that way.
1-800-423-8255 makes the micro lending connection with the father of it in Bangladesh, and the idea, the embodiment of the idea of it in the world, Muhammad Yunus. 1-800-423-TALK. Jonathan Mordack joins us by phone from Princeton University, where he teaches economics. Jonathan Mordack, what kind of an example does this micro lending institution give the world, and are there catches in it?
Well, as an economist working on effective ways to alleviate poverty, these programs and other micro credit banks really are truly inspiring. But there are certainly catches, and we really need to keep these accomplishments in perspective. They're real, but we're still a long, long way from making the kinds of claims, for example, that microcredit could make a major dent in world poverty rates. Everything we know about the decreases in poverty over the last 20, 30 years around the world suggests that that's going to be accomplished by creating good jobs at good wages and through improvements in agriculture. That microcredit can do great things for its clients and can make a huge difference in their lives, but there's still tensions there, and the tensions between the reality and the rhetoric of microfinance. We really need to step back and reassess where we are in this conversation.
Go right ahead. I mean, does it sustain itself, as Muhammad Yunus says?
I think the best evidence that we have today, and we certainly need more evidence, the best evidence is that this idea of creating banks which are good business and also banks which can alleviate poverty at the same time is a vision that we really haven't met yet. The programs which are doing best as banks, for example, the programs that Maria Otero has been involved with, have not proven as effective in their depth of outreach to the poor. They're still doing good things, but not really to the kind of households and women that Muhammad Yunus's programs are representing. Whereas Muhammad Yunus's program, the Grameen Bank, has a terrific record in terms of poverty alleviation, but I think when we take a hard look at the accounts, really is not doing nearly as well in terms of profitability. It's very hard to look at the accounts and to come away with the conclusion that it's truly covering its costs and truly profitable. And that raises big questions about how we want to see microcredit. It still can be a very, very good program, but a program that will require ongoing support. And the question to me is whether...
How much ongoing support and from whom?
Well, Muhammad Yunus can speak to this probably better than I, but continuing support from the government of Bangladesh and international donors and people like you and me who want to use our charity dollars to to go further.
He says he's outgrown the support. Mohammed Yunus?
Yes. Well, Jonathan, thank you for your remarks. To clarify, we never depended on the support from the government of Bangladesh. I mean, you can blame us for many other things, but not that one. If you think government of Bangladesh, probably you can only think, you can say we borrowed from central bank.
Yeah.
Where government of Bangladesh has guaranteed the loan, because there's no way we could take the money from the central bank under the central bank rules, not because we are depending on the governments to support, but the rules request that we must have that government guarantee. Otherwise, central bank cannot lend us the money. It is the fault of their rule, not fault of ours. We can pay their loans, and we have every loan we ever took, we paid on the dot every time. No, never missed a single installment for a second. So we did that. So just to say that the government guarantee is there, saying that we depend on the government subsidy, that I don't think would be fair. But again, we go into a controversy whether the central bank loan is a subsidized loan or is a market loan. If every other bank in Bangladesh takes central bank loan from the central bank, and that's the job of the central bank to lend money to the central bank, if they can take it, we can take it. So we are no different than anybody else. If some calculation comes up and say, hey, there is some subsidy in that interest rate, that is something which goes to everybody, not just to Grameen Bank. And we borrowed from the market by issuing bonds with giving proper market rate, because otherwise they will never lend money to us. And since 95, we have not taken any money from outside as a grant or a soft loan.
Can I, Jonathan Morag, I'm less interested in the subsidy question. I mean, if the system is working, it ought to get a little subsidy. I'm more interested in this question, as you say, microlending doesn't give people better seed or new ways to grow crops necessarily. Is it good, though, this emphasis on entrepreneurship and small ownership and small business toward the goal of greater productivity?
Well, certainly for many, many people, this is a viable option and beats other possibilities. Agriculture is the other possibility, but for poor women, that has been a less and less viable option. And so certainly entrepreneurship can help at this at these very low levels. But for most poor households, the answer to getting out of poverty is going to be finding better jobs, more employment, and better wages. And I think that really has to be the key.
My comment on that, microcredit doesn't say stop everything. There shouldn't be any job employment anymore. I'm not saying that. Nobody says that. You create as many jobs as you want. It's an option to people that when you don't have a job, at least you have microcredit and carry on with your thing. And Bangladesh will never create as many jobs for every single people with 130 million people in that country. That kind of economy is not in the near future. So at least people can support themselves with their own efforts, creating self-employment. Every job doesn't have to be a wage-based employment. You can create your own employment and go ahead and do it. And for women, particularly in Bangladesh, we are working, 95% of our borrowers are women. I don't think those jobs will ever come in their lifetime. So just to wait for that kind of job, I don't think it would be a good strategy. So if they come, nobody is stopping them, please do come. And their contribution, Grameen's contribution in GNP, GDP, has been as great as the power sector of the whole country. So that is contributing to the size of the economy itself.
Mohammed Yunus, stand by. And Jonathan Modak, too. His call has turned 1-800-423-8255. We're talking about microlending and microcredit. Darmina is on the line. Welcome.
Hi. Christopher, I really appreciate being on your show, and
this is a
subject that's very near and dear to my heart. I serve on the board of the National Community Reinvestment Coalition, which works to increase access to credit and capital across the country. My question to you, Mr. Yunus, is what lessons have mainstream banks in Bangladesh taken from your model?
Not much. They still continue to their old system, but just because everybody is criticizing them for not lending money to the poor, because Grameen has highlighted that issue. So every bank now has a microcredit program, a tiny program, just to protect themselves from the criticism. We have them. And we are doing the same thing Grameen doing. But compared to the whole bank's operation, this would be a tiny little piece in one corner. So that way, they have not changed their attitude, they have not changed their policies, anything. But we keep pounding on that. It's not just a token program. You have to address the whole issue, redesign the entire banking concept.
Jeremina?
Yes, may I respond? Have you ever responded? I don't know if you know about the Community Reinvestment Act, which we
yes,
have.
Yes, I'm familiar with it.
Have you ever tried to work legislatively to pass that kind of legislation that would provide more access, or at least for the possibility of more credit to people?
Yes, we have not tried on that in Bangladesh. We are busy lobbying with the government to create legislative framework for microcredit itself, so that anybody who would like to create a financial institution along the line of opening doors for the poor people, they can become legitimate financial institutions. But your suggestion is good. Maybe we should be trying those other things too, helping existing institutions to open up more within the legal framework.
Darmina, thank you. 1-800-423-8255, the microcredit connection. How much money would you like? Saminas is on the line.
Hi.
Hi.
Welcome.
Yeah. I'm calling because the question I had was about how much control do the women who get the loans have over what they do with it? Because I worked in a slum in Dhaka, Bangladesh for a while, and one thing that I kept hearing was that often the loan was used as a form of dowry. For example, when the parents were arranging the marriage, they would say to the girl's family that, yes, you know, we'll get married, but after the marriage, we'd want the girl to take this much in loan, and then she'll hand that over to her husband. And also would hear stories about how the women would get a loan, and they would hand it over to a brother or to a father. And even though the women themselves would report back, really the loan was being managed and really controlled by the male members of the family. So I was wondering if Dr. Yunus was aware of that, and like what safeguards were taken to prevent this from happening.
Yeah. Saminas, being a woman is not easy. You can see that.
Yeah.
It's a lot of problems. Whatever you said, these are the problems they have to face every day. One study done on Grameen's loans and other loans and microcredit tell us that 61% of the women who took this loan either have no control over their money or have very partial control over their money. And people started coming and bashing at us, see, your borrowers have no control over their money. I said, this is one way of looking at it. Well, if I were you, I would celebrate that 39% of the borrowers have complete control over the money. In Bangladesh, this is a cause for celebration, that at least Grameen has created a situation where 39% of the women who borrowed from Grameen Bank has total control over their money, and 61% have partial or no control. I said, we should be working together to make sure tomorrow if it moves from 39% to 40% and 41%. That will be the direction. I don't claim to have solved every other problem. There are so many different problems if you are working with women. And I hope you'll be helpful to us.
Saminas, thank you. 1-800-423-8255, the microcredit connection. Gail Ferraro is on the line. She's a documentary filmmaker. Over 7 months, she spent time outside Mirzapur in Bangladesh making a movie about 100 or so women who had taken out loans from the Grameen Bank. Gail Ferraro, what did you find, and what are they doing with the loans?
Hi. Thanks, Chris, and congratulations on your book, Dr. Yunus.
Thank you.
Banker to the Poor. It's nice to hear you.
Thank you.
When I was there, it's hard to see the women actually involved in milking a cow or husking rice. The days there are so different, but the center meetings are extremely powerful. Those weekly meetings, mm-hmm. You go in them, and it's just so exciting. And
these are the loan committees, in effect.
Okay.
Yeah, exactly.
What did you learn?
Well, The thing that's really amazing, the loans, the caller before was talking about how she felt that, you know, there's all these problems still. And that's actually, you know, extremely true. And that's what the film is really about. The documentary, it talks about how serious the other problems are. The money's one aspect, but at this, the center meetings, the women, a real community is developing, and in a way that we don't really have in the United States. It's really hard to find sort of that kind of key point. And there's 16 decisions, which is the name of the documentary. I thought that was one of the most important pieces. Money's money, and in the United States, we just sort of become accustomed to having access, at least middle class families, and. What I felt was really important was the 16 decisions, which is a social charter. And as Dr. Yunus explains in the documentary, they evolved over, the women made them up in annual national meetings. And they're everything from boiling your water and building pit latrines to we won't have child marriage. And they establish a basis for all the women to be on the same page.
I want to ask Mohammed Yunus, what are the 16 decisions, and did they come out of the bank, or did the bank learn them from the people?
We learned it from the people. It went through months and months and years to get into those decisions. It came one by one, not in one lump. And they talk about what they should be looking forward to, what they are trying to do. It's like overcoming the dowry problem, which is a serious problem in Bangladesh, because when a girl is to be married off, you have to give a lot of money with her so that somebody will agree to marry her. So it becomes a big burden on the family. So this, how to stop that kind of thing. One of the 16 decisions said that we shall not take any dowry when we are arranging marriage for our son, and we shall not give any dowry when we are arranging marriage for our daughter, so that we can resolve it. And it goes into literacy for the children and sending children to school and so on. What Gail has said about the difficulties and so on, and about the 16 decisions, yes, there are problems, but we try to see we can improve on the situation, like the election results that I'm talking about. These are very concrete things. 4,000 Grameen members became elected in the local bodies. This is not something of a speculation. This is a concrete fact. Without Grameen, probably they would never even dare to think about getting running in the election and contesting election and asking for people's
vote. I want to ask Jonathan Mordack, what if this isn't about money and economics at all? What if it's really a kind of social revolution?
I think that's exactly the way to think about it. I mean, we've heard this hour about the tremendous social changes that are going on in Bangladesh, and they are very real. But we need to think then about how this works as a model, how to get it done in lots of other places. And there, I think we really need to go back and think about the economic structures and how viable it is in other places. And that's what takes us back to these questions about how subsidized it is, et cetera.
Yeah, I should just put another one, that how it created an opportunity for us to change societal arrangements. We have introduced a mobile telephone in the villages, and Grameen provides a loan to the Grameen borrower, a woman who takes the mobile phone, a handset, and starts selling the service of the telephone. She never saw a telephone in her life before. In many villages, she never even saw electricity in her life before. Now she has a solar panel powered mobile telephone that she's offering to the villagers to make use of, and making money by doing that. Mm-hmm. And she, within a couple of months or 3 months, she become expert on telephoning. She knows the area codes, the country codes of different countries and places, and the tariff for each country and so on. And a person, how quickly she transformed herself from being someone who was just raising chicken and poultry or cow, now has a modern technology in her hand, and be able to master the technology. And tomorrow, probably, she will be selling the internet services in the villages, because internet service and the mobile telephone comes in the same way. So information technology is making inroad, and that kind of thing, you can think about providing healthcare services, education, literacy programs, anything with that.
Connections everywhere. This is fascinating. Mohammed Yunus, thank you enormously for the short course on microlending.
Thank you.
At Princeton, Jonathan Mordack, thank you. Thank you, Gail Ferraro. Gail Ferraro's documentary, titled 16 Decisions, can be seen at the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston on May 4th and May 6th. Thanks also to Maria Otero, who joined us earlier in the hour. Thanks for help today from John Hoder, Rebecca Smuckler, and Kim Bichari. Our website is theconnectiononeword.org. Our website producer is Jim Norris. The Connection is produced by Catherine Bidwell, Hitesh Hatti, John Holt, Jill Kaufman, Amy McDonald, and Keith Shields. Mary McGrath is our chief microlender. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation.
PRI, Public Radio International.
This is WBUR. Coming up on Here and Now at Noon next, in addition to all the news, reports on street performance tryouts. The pet doc separates cats in a major cat fight.